All right, welcome to Patron Live Q&A number 7. How are we doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. How are you doing, Thomas?
Oh, you know, just trying to manage YouTube. makes me feel old and out of touch with technology that I don't understand how YouTube works. But we got it. We're here. We got some viewers.
It doesn't really seem like it's a YouTube chat yet until we've got someone calling us cucks. So,
yeah. Most importantly, we have questions. We've got patron questions because we put the Q&A, Andrew, put up the Q&A thread nice and early for everybody to ask their hard-hitting questions. I actually think, though, we can ignore all that and just focus on talking about ogres in Middle Earth. I think that's the... I'm going to give about an hour, about a 60, times out about 63-minute speech about ogres and... Middle Earth, because I apparently said that, even though like when I know there aren't ogres and or somebody said I said warlocks in Middle Earth. I don't know. Who knows what I've been saying? Look, I know the difference between all that. I just didn't say it right. OK, no, I get it because I very clearly
I was hoping you were going to say, I know the difference. I just don't care.
No, I've always been a Lord of the Rings fan. And yeah. I think I was when I thought there was ogres, I was thinking of the trolls. I just got that mixed up.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a
common simple, legal mistake.
Anyone could have made
it's a common first year law mistake. So anybody. All right. Let's see what we want to do for our first question. I think we can go up to the top here.
All right.
During your tax conversation, this is from Bear the Bull. There was no mention of the elimination of the personal exemption, which wipes out a majority of the increase of the standard deduction. I've noticed barely anyone mentions it when talking about the new tax law. Is there a reason it wasn't brought up on the show? What do you think?
Yeah. So factually, the personal exemption is about $4,000, maybe exactly $4,000. And the difference between an exemption and a deduction is the above the line, below the line. Exemption is above the line. So you can claim it and then either itemize or claim the standardized deduction or as will be the case going forward, not do that. The doubling of the standardized deduction is a $12,000 benefit. So yeah, it certainly wipes out a big chunk of it. Why didn't we talk about it during our tax episode with Tony D? Because I think folks are pretty clear politically where we stand on this tax deal. It's grotesquely regressive and we're opposed to it. And I wanted to make sure that we were focusing that episode on kind of more of a nuts and bolts of what's in the new law, as opposed to, covering it from a political standpoint. So that was my thought process. You know, we get emails when we do a deep dive, we get emails that say, hey, how come you didn't talk about this latest horrible Trump thing? When we cover the horrible Trump thing, we get emails that say, can't you just go back to doing classic opening arguments and, you know, deep dives into, you know, what it means to have, adverse possession or stuff like that. We try and hit a balance. And I was trying to do not flog the politics on a more practical episode there. So that was my reason. That's my reason.
All right. Well, that one and done here. Let's go to the next one. Congress ruined my shutdown joke asks, this may have been covered a while back, but in light of Citizens United, would it require a constitutional amendment to institute a system of public financing for elections? Could campaign spending be limited to only funds provided through a public financing system?
And the answer to that is yes, that would require a constitutional amendment. Ooh. So what happened in Citizens United is that there was the group Citizens United was a 501c4 group that was trying to air a film critical of Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential election. And I don't mean to pause here. So there are a couple of things in connection with that, right? Like, so the first is there obviously is a First Amendment right to make movies about political figures that attack them, right? And there was this sort of perceived, well, let me not go down the perceived route, but the question is, I would tend to view campaign contributions and airing this movie as falling under the rubric of time, place, and manner restrictions, right? Like, I would want to say, hey, look, if you hate Hillary Clinton and you want to make a movie that says Hillary Clinton is terrible, which, you know, lots of people have done, right? Dinesh D'Souza did that in 2016. Go ahead and do that, but we want to have some restrictions on when that can air, right? We don't want the Koch brothers to be able to buy up literally all the ad time right before an election and do nothing but air this movie, right? So Citizens United basically said they can do that. And it built upon an earlier decision called Buckley versus Valeo that says, in the political campaign arena, money is equivalent to speech. So, you know, one of the misconceptions about Citizens United is that is the idea that Citizens United said money equals speech. But actually, that was an earlier case. So you put that together and we're in this present situation. I think there are real problems with the Citizens United decision that probably won't surprise anybody. But as it is applied right now, unless the Supreme Court overturns Citizens United, unless there is a constitutional amendment, that would preclude a system of public financing for elections. Right? Because in order to make that work, you have to say, in order for public financing to work, we used to have an open-ended public financing for the presidential election, right? Like, you got public money to run your presidential campaign, and then Obama decided that he was not going to take the public financing for the general election in 2008 because he could raise more money on his own. And so he forewent that, the spending caps that were associated with that. And now that's gone, right? So in other words, in a post-Citizens United world, you could have public funding, but it doesn't work unless you can also stop other expenditures. And it's the stopping that Citizens United.
Well, but aren't there's still limits to how much we can give, right?
There are limits to how much you can give, but there aren't limits to how much people can spend in terms of directly influencing, right? So, and I should be clear that the Citizens United decision upheld the provision of the elections law that includes requirements on tracing the money. So, I mean, I think in a post-Citizens United world, the best way to kind of mitigate the damage is to require more transparency, to make it more clear where every dollar that goes to outside 501c4 groups, where it comes from.
I guess maybe I'm confused on in terms of the needing a constitutional amendment thing. If there's a law that's setting these certain limits and restrictions, couldn't we also pass a law that says, okay, everybody can contribute $20 or something and make it so you can't, it's so low that effectively a public financing option would be better? Or am I missing something?
But here's where that was, you could say you can only contribute $20 to a campaign, or even you could restrict that to a 501c4, but there's nothing to stop the Koch brothers or, you know, let's say George Soros or, you know, whatever, from starting their own 501c4, spending their own money, not donating it to somebody else.
Okay.
And then using that to flood the airwaves with stuff. So that's where that part comes in.
Okay.
It's the worst. It's the worst of all worlds in terms of when you think about the actual social implications, right? but there's where we are.
Yeah. Geez. That's that sucks. I'm surprised that we can't even pass a law to fix it. It's such a devastating blow that we're going to need a constitutional amendment, which will probably never happen. So that's awesome. Let's ask a lighter hearted one here. Yay. Damien Kumar asks, do I have to stop for stop signs in parking lots?
Well, that wasn't a question I expected. Yes, you have to stop for stop signs.
Says who? What about the entity driving business as Thomas, or no, I don't know.
Yes, that only has to stop for 80% of stop signs. No, but it's kind of funny that you asked this question, because one of the things that you go through, like the first week of law school, are all of the sort of crazy hypotheticals like this that are much crazier than, you know, stop sign in the middle of a parking lot, no one's around, why don't I blow through that? And basically, I mean, to sort of summarize down, the answer is, if you don't stop at a stop sign in a parking lot, you can be arrested. And then what you can do is you can, or, you know, ticketed or whatever. And then at your hearing or at your trial, you can argue, you know, mitigating circumstances. You can argue, no, here was the reason. I was in a completely empty parking lot, and yes, I blew through the stop sign, but, you know, you ought not to sentence me for that. And then it's up to the judge, right? So, which overlaps with our longstanding OA message of there's always fairness in the law, but stop for those damn parking signs.
That reminds me, I've got my stupid speeding ticket thing. Well, it's so frustrating because it's not in the computer system. I keep trying to look it up online and it's just not there. Yeah. And they say, well, if it's not there, it doesn't mean anything. You still have to do it. And I got an update in the mail a month after the ticket that said correction. And then it listed the speed he said I was going. And I was like, what, how? So I get a ticket, and then a month later, he writes a thing saying, oh, here's the speed it was. Like, I move for a bad court thingy.
that seems a little weird.
Yeah, it's like he didn't write it on the thing or something. I don't know.
Is that maybe he was amending the original, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you could think about it. I accidentally wrote, you know, 63, but I meant to, you know,
so I looked at the original ticket and it just said it didn't have a speed on it, so I guess maybe that's why it's not in the system too. It's just whatever. Weird. I'm so annoyed.
When's your hearing?
I don't know. It's in February, so my alarm bells mentally haven't gone off until the calendar changes to February. Then I'm gonna have tomorrow to go figure that out. So Alice asks, year in, how fucked have we been? More or less than you expected. This is a chance for us to do everybody's favorite thing, which is to be pundits.
Why don't you start?
Sure. I think that there's so many layers to that question, because there's like a normalizing that has happened a little bit, and it is a bit surprising. And I think the boring State of the Union is an element of that, which is, I think we've been reminded in the last few months how much Trump is not the problem, how much Republicans are a big portion of the problem, and how much Republicans are defending him and endorsing him. And who was the I think it's McConnell said like 2017 was the best year for conservatives in his lifetime or something like that. Like, I mean, this isn't Trump. He really is not doing that much that Republicans don't want. And one thing that I am paying particular attention to is how much the narrative switched from, oh, we just want to stop illegal immigrants, to stopping immigrants. And that happened so, I mean, I don't know how subtle it was, but it happened sort of seamlessly. And that's something where we're not doing a good job of capturing just how xenophobic that is. And the fact that the deal that's being talked about now is, it's so odd, because every time somebody tries to correct, you know, when you say, well, it's xenophobia, and they're like, oh, no, they're just against illegal immigrants. Well, you like laws, don't you? They're just for laws. And now we're to the point where the deal is going to be that in exchange for a deal on DACA members, which are technically speaking here illegally, in exchange for that, we're going to cut down on legal immigration. So it's the opposite, literally the opposite. It's cutting legal immigration in exchange for allowing some illegal, technically speaking, illegal immigrants. I know we've talked about the problematic usage of that phrase, but in their minds, in conservatives' minds, that's what it is. And it just goes to show, along with the shithole comments and all that, like that should be alarming, and we're not alarmed enough about it because Trump is able to read from a teleprompter for, you know, 60 minutes or whatever he did. I didn't watch it because it's a waste of time. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways that the fact that it's become normalized and the fact that it's just the party is able to, the Republican Party is able to normalize it and turn it into, oh, it's just partisan politics. Anyone who thought Trump was going to be horrible, they're just partisans. They're just, you know, they're liberals. That's what they think. That is really harmful. And I think so. In short answer, in some ways we're a little less fucked, but in other ways we're long term fucked, I think.
Yeah, I want to sign on to all of that. It, in my view, the normalization that is the most harmful is the idea that the shirts and skins politics, I need to defend my team, now extends to criminal behavior.
Yeah.
Right. Like it is just the idea that I look at it on the other. If it were Hillary Clinton in office and the first thing she did was, you know, put, you know, was an equivalent of Jared Kushner, right? Like, you know, put Chelsea Clinton on the staff and like it would, we would be out there saying, no, this violates the law, right? Like, and it would be bad for Democrats to be like, oh no, later, it's no problem if, you know, they're engineering a tax cut that goes entirely to the benefit of Bill Clinton's personal holdings, right? I mean, like, I've said this before, right? Like, I believe in this country's legal system. That's why it's my profession, right? I consider myself a patriot, and it's just it's hard to watch that get shredded. And that's not necessarily something that shows up in, you know, bills and ordinances and the like, but I think it shows up in dialogue. So.
Oh man. Yeah, that too. So, so there's your answer. I got it. This one is, it wasn't heavily favorited, which is how I go by these questions, but I'm doing it anyway. Erections have consequences asked, what does the P in P. Andrew Torres stand for? And then someone, Justin Slobberin Citizen Wilder, said, I bet it's Philip. It has a good flow to it. Andrew Philip Torres. And then Saka Shithole Thwackasumi.
Wait, what is that one?
Saka Shithole Thwackasumi. That's pretty good. Yeah, nice. Says, this good. Has been answered before. It's Plurbius. Oh man!
Yeah, it is indeed Plurbius.
That's awesome.
That's Philip. So
yeah, that's what's funny. I wonder if that person knew and was just pretending they guessed it. But
I checked over on the YouTube live chat feed, and Hadley Roberts asked, "I'd be quite interested in a Patreon mini special about how the show is made. It looks like Andrew is recording in a sauna, or does he have a podcast?" Which I thought was great. This lovely wood paneling behind me is vintage in my basement. If I had stayed at a big law firm, I would be back in my lovely
next Q&A. You need house. To do it in a when a steal a hotel bathrobe and just
oh
do
my
it
gosh.
In that.
Yeah,
just
I will
fun.
Do next one. I will do in like the Holiday Inn bathrobe. But, no, I live in a tiny little house with old 1970s style stuff on the wall because I decided to stop working for a firm and start, you know, vetting dick jokes and podcasting for a living. And this is the house you get when you make those life choices. So,
oh man,
thank you, Hadley.
Jesse Simmons has a couple. Well, one that I'm going to ask, but also there's another one that I want to defend our honor here because I swear you answered it last time, which is if you get arrested and say, I want a lawyer without having any existing relationship with an attorney, what happens? I thought you answered that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that doesn't. You just get a lawyer, right? There wasn't.
Yeah, you get to make your phone call.
Yeah.
And you either call your lawyer, or if you don't have one, you call your family and say, get me a lawyer. And then they are not allowed to ask you questions until your lawyer gets there, which is what you want, by the way.
That's, right.
But I take that piece of advice.
Jesse has a second question. What level of disdain for Supreme Court judges is acceptable within the legal community? If Thomas got elected president in 2028 and called Neil Gorsuch the fake judge with a stolen seat, what would the response be?
well, as we've seen, nothing. Would be, yeah. Clapping laughter.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I mean, if Thomas is elected president, I'm hoping that I would be on your short list for the Supreme Court. So,
we'll see. We'll see.
I'll sit in my resume.
Well, I honestly, by that time, you won't be young enough. I'm going to nominate a 13-year-old prodigy who's going to be in the seat forever. That's what I would do.
I should nominate my son by then.
Ooh, that's a good idea. And then also, I want to point out that the actual president has bashed, you know, why am I blanking?
Everyone.
On? Has bashed everyone, true. But also, you know, what's her name? Has actually done that to our sitting Supreme Court justice. I'm too distracted by the neighbor's cat that's barking. Oh, no, it's a dog. Gosh, I always think it's a cat. And I remember cats don't ever ruin other people's recordings. It's only dogs that do that. Anyway, on to Justin Slobber and Citizen Wilder. Again, another one in here. Hypothetically, if you were expecting to be charged with a crime and your attorney was present at your home when the police served a search warrant or arrested you, would your attorney be allowed to testify at your trial? Would a second attorney have to examine them as a witness? Would they? Oh, that's interesting. Would they be barred from being your attorney if they were a witness to a crime? Now, not since William Jennings Bryan has a. Do attorneys often get questioned in an actual trial? Like they become witnesses?
It can happen. I actually had a case like this in which both sides had negotiated a contract. Both sides had lawyers as part of the deal making team, and we took the position that those lawyers were not engaged in rendering legal advice, right? So, you know, if you and I decide to chat about the podcast or about podcasting in general, that stuff isn't privileged. And so I could be potentially a witness in a trial in connection with that. And so that's, you know, so that's kind of the situation in which I've seen that come up. I have to admit, I was having a hard time sort of following me, like, your lawyer's at your house during the search warrant. I guess the idea is that that he would be a fact witness, and the lawyer could be a fact witness, could testify about what he saw factually without waiving attorney-client privilege. But it would be, man, I would love to be the prosecutor cross-examining because what you're trying to get is you're trying to get an answer that waives the privilege, and then you'd be able to invade attorney-client privilege, and it would be amazing.
We can put it on the list.
It'd be great for you.
We can put it on the list of cooler things to happen in a legal movie that we, you know.
There you go. Weird stuff. Great.
Excuse me.
We're about to try. You want to promote Lot Awful Movies 15 that we just recorded?
Yeah, yeah. We everybody Lot Awful Movies. What was it? 15?
I believe it's 15.
15. Yeah. Man, beyond a reasonable doubt, this is a real movie, sort of. It has Michael Douglas in it, right? And we did it with Sharon Frankel, the host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor, and it was not delightful. It was a horrible movie, but we did our best. So look out for that coming to a theater near you. And another one from Justin here, but I already know the answer to this, but I'm just using this to remind you, Andrew. Have you ever seen Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul? You need to watch both of those. They're really good.
No, I do. I need to. The answer is no. I need to. It is on the very top of my binge list, although then I got distracted because when I flew to Australia, I binged the first season of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. And it was really, really good. So then I wound up watching the second season. So that inserted its way into my TV watching hierarchy. Mm. It displaced Breaking Bad. But Breaking Bad is up there. Plus Stranger Things. I want to get into Stranger Things.
Oh, God, you haven't watched Stranger Things?
I know.
There's not a lot of law questions in that, but...
No, but still.
Oh, man. All right. Rapture Squirrel of the Apocalypse asks, Smucko...
You do the question first, and then I'll...
Oh, Schmuckalorange, I think, is supposed to be a Trump nickname here. is taking up most of our attention with his narcissistic antics. I would like your opinion on the less apparent damage that AG Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions is doing to the Justice Department and or the judiciary. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So A, I like that they've specified that they are rapture squirrel of the apocalypse, as if, right, you could be a rapture squirrel of something else, right? Isn't that inherent? Anyway, yeah, look, Jeff Sessions is terrible, and we've highlighted some of the crazy things that he's done, right? Like, you know, we just did an entire episode talking about his desire to crack down on marijuana use, which is just sort of mind-boggling. And if you want to talk about impeding, you know, you want to talk about free market, you know, this is something that clearly impedes legitimate business in, you know, a dozen states. Something that has totally gone under the radar that I think we're going to see in 2018 is the restaffing and the memoranda that was issued directing the Department of Justice to focus its anti-discrimination efforts on under-talented white kids who don't get into schools. So look for that. That's unbelievable, right? So look, like it from a political standpoint, I think you summarized it best when you were kind of giving the State of the Union answer, and that is what Trump has done is legitimate the worst impulses that every Republican has wanted to do but had too much of a sense of shame to not do, right? Like, we would not have gotten this tax bill under a George W. Bush, right? It wouldn't have been that brazen to increase the bottom bracket, cut the corporate tax rate in half. And, you know, it was really just, I open up drilling in the Anwar. I mean, it was just crazy.
Other legitimate tax concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a result of, I think, Republicans who otherwise had some shame going, well, look, as long as I stay one step ahead of Trump, there are no consequences for that. So it's bad. So yeah, I agree with Rupture Squirrel.
Also, another thing that in the Fire and Fury book was it's hilarious and a little sad, but how abusive Trump is toward Sessions. And I know he deserves it, but that's what's so funny, because so many of Trump's alleged accomplishments are actually things that Sessions has done. And because anyone who kind of outshines Trump at all, he just abuses to oblivion. And for other reasons that it's not worth getting into right now. But like, there's Trump almost fired. Like, that was real. That was real news that he almost fired him. And it's just hilarious to me that it's like the guy who's actually the effective villain who should be Trump's, like, you know, claim to any sort of, you know, accomplishments that he should be proud of, he almost fired just because of some pride bullshit, you know. But anyway,
I got to ask you, did Fire and Fury shed any light on how Rod Rosenstein got hired? Because I've been trying to figure that one out.
How he got hired. Right. When was he hired? Now I'm blanking.
Oh, very early on. I mean, you know,
so he wasn't already there, and then he just was next in line.
No, he was, I'm trying to think. Now I'm blanking.
I'll have to go back and
attorney in Maryland.
I'll have to go back and look. I seem to remember something about it, but I consume so much Trump bullshit that's hard to keep it straight.
It illustrates, and I wonder. I mean, I happen to know Rod personally. So when that happened, I was able to say, look, here's a guy who's a conservative Republican, but a decent guy.
Oh, now I'm remembering. Yeah. What they do talk about, which I found fascinating, was the Fire and Fury, you know, what's his name again? Wolf. He characterizes it, and I think pretty believably so, as Rosenstein came on. Now, I don't know exactly your question of how he came on, but when he was on, he went through the motions of analyzing and giving that, you know, kind of excuse for Comey's performance, and that, oh, he didn't handle this properly. And as he was, like, working on that, as we know, and trying to actually legitimately lend some cover to it for some long-term process of maybe firing Comey, Trump just fires him and then says, nah, I did it because of the Russia thing. And Wolf thinks that that Mueller is very clearly Rosenstein's revenge for that thing, for essentially making him into a joke. I mean, when he writes a memo that's like allegedly this justification for firing Comey, and then Trump can't even focus enough for like a week to stick to it, and essentially professionally embarrasses him and makes him look like a total hack. That's how it's presented in the book, like Mueller, and that it would be such poetic justice if it ends up being Trump's downfall, because it really would have been just making Rosenstein look like a fool, which would have caused it, I think. But yeah. Who knows? Fucking Patreon. Okay. It keeps taking me off the page. But the one that I was on while I reload it was asked by – it was a funny name, so – okay, I can get back to it. The question is from my kid is asleep while I'm still watching Paw Patrol. and this one, I love this one. It just should be pretty simple. But do grandparents have any legal right to see their grandkids?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's going to be situationally dependent, right? So in other words, if parents are in the picture, then no, grandparents have no independent right, as far as I know. When parents are out of the picture, then the court undertakes a determination to figure out what's in the best interests of minor children. And that's where grandparents can come in and sort of say, typically what will happen is a court will appoint a guardian ad litem for minor children that are subject to its jurisdiction. That's a separate lawyer. So if you have a separate ongoing proceeding, then the kids get a lawyer that is paid for by the court. And then that lawyer acts in the best interests of the kids. But I don't think there's any independent right of grandparents to see their kids.
Interesting. Yeah. And important legal correction here. I was trying to remember it as I was loading it. It's my kid is asleep. Why am I still watching Paw Patrol? Does that change the answer? No, I just want to get that right.
I can remember when Alex was a toddler under the age of two, he used to watch this show called The Wonder Pets that was just terrible. I mean, it was aimed at 2-year olds, so you don't expect it to be great, but it was like little animal puppets, and everyone, they had to save a different kind of animal puppet, and they sang a little song about saving the animal puppet. And we were binge watching on, Nickelodeon with him sitting on my lap, all of these episodes of The Wonder Pets. And then all of a sudden, I just started laughing hysterically. It was like I hit this overload, and it was like, The Wonder Pets are hilarious now. And So I'm with you. It was not Paw Patrol. It was The Wonder Pets, but I'm with you, anonymous patron.
I'm looking forward to, being able to watch stuff I want to watch, and with the excuse that it's that's for Phoebe. I'm a big SpongeBob fan, so I'll have to watch some SpongeBob. But all right, there is a question.
Alex hated Transformers when he was younger because it was too loud. There was too much noise. And so anyway.
Poor Andrew.
It made me so sad. I was
the biggest parenting challenge of your life. Jed asks, and this is a kind of a long, involved question. I'll see if I can distill it down. But Jed is asking if an originalist view of the Constitution would treat airspace as essentially not federalized. And it's like property, like my property goes above my house all the way into the atmosphere. Would that be something necessarily an originalist would have to think, because that's what they kind of how they treated it at the time? So do you have any thoughts on that?
So I want to defend my originalist peeps here. There is this really, really weird libertarian propaganda that is going on right now that is designed to convince people that the founding fathers were libertarians. And that's not true. Now, look, like they were strongly influenced by Locke, and obviously a lot of Lockean rhetoric sort of taken to extremes underlies some of what libertarians profess to believe. But like, I'm strongly influenced by Locke, right? Like you don't have to go from that to the, you know, kind of Randian position. So it is, right? It is a, the hardcore libertarian conception of property rights is that you own that like wedge shaped, yeah, you know, from your property up to the heavens and then continuing down to the core of the earth. Boy, like, you know, I guess that would mean that when you had, you know, when you had like when you had a satellite go overhead, that it would have to pay rent to you. You'd have to, I don't know. I'm sure libertarians have some kind of like conglomerate proposed that's going to collect all the rents on the satellites passing overhead. But
I would hope that that's something that even hardcore libertarians would admit. Like maybe this should just be federal or something like that. That's maybe the
let's get Austin Peterson on the show, and he's running for office somewhere.
Who is this?
I think it's Austin Peterson. The he came in. He was the guy who challenged Gary Johnson for the Libertarian nomination in 2016. Who ran on the like Gary Johnson is, you know, is only a poser libertarian. Like you have to have Ayn Rand tattooed on your eyeballs to get this nomination.
Well, I wonder if the libertarians are doing the same thing every party does when they lose, which is like, damn, we just need to go further libertarian. That was the problem. That's why we didn't win in 2016, people. Let's ask, this one's interesting. David Morgan asks, who gives international tribunals like the one in the article that was trying Serbian war criminals and courts like the ones for Nuremberg jurisdiction? Who gives them jurisdiction and what laws do they use to convict the defendants?
So the answer to that is nobody. We could get our friend Aaron Ravi on the show. The Nuremberg trials are sort of a staple of philosophy courses and philosophy of law classes because there are no there certainly are international agreements, but there's no single codified body of international law to which countries have uniformly submitted, you know, to that jurisdiction. So the alternative at Nuremberg was to just execute the Nazis, right? And so our idea and I think it would come out differently today, I mean, sadly. But again, one of the things that I love about American ideals, you know, you want sort of that more patriotism coming through was we fought World War II for principles, and we want to showcase those principles to the world, and we want to establish the notion that there are some things that, regardless of whether they're codified, that just are common across every country. And so it was Robert Jackson, who was a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, chaired the Nuremberg tribunals, but there was no independent legal authority for it.
Interesting. Wow, it was not what I expected. But all right, there's one here that I found interesting. Reverend Bishop Parsons asks, "What is the law surrounding fair use of legal documents? If I wanted to write a book about a court case, can I quote extensively from published court documents, or does it need to meet the fair use doctrine of quoting copyrighted material?" And I could broaden that to like, how does that work with any government related documents? I mean, do they have some sort of copyright, or are we able to just use it as much as we want?
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. It took me a second to figure out where the question was going. You retain your copy. Let's use, for example, the lawsuit over Milo's book. Right. Because that, you know, we tweeted out, right, all the drafts got leaked and like it turned out the editor was making, you know, snarky comments in the margins. And, you know, it was like You really need to have evidence here. This claim is idiotic. You know, it was pretty funny. If the entirety of Milo's book is included as an exhibit in a court document, and that is, and court documents are presumptively public, you can then go download Exhibit A, right? And you could download that entire book.
Doesn't mean you could sell it, though, right?
Go ahead, ask your question. I think you were about to ask.
You're looking laggy now, so I'm sorry if it's lagging. But I was just saying, doesn't mean you could like sell it, could you? It's just you can access
it. Right. Yes. So you could access. In other words, the court is essentially engaged in the fair use of the document, but the document retains its original copyright. And so if you wanted to comment on that, you might have access to materials that you wouldn't otherwise have access to. But in order to do that, you're still going to have to go through fair use. You're still
I think the questioner, though, is actually asking about like the legal doc. So like, let's say there's a Supreme Court justice writes an opinion and you're writing a book about it. Are you just like, yeah, whatever, I can write as much about that as I want, because it's not, or does anybody own a copyright on the Supreme Court justices, on Scalia's, well, not a good example, but a living justice, on their opinion, like everything they wrote in it, who is that, just we can do whatever we want with it, or no?
So the answer to that is not a simple yes or no. The answer to the Supreme Court opinion is yes, those are in the public domain. You can do whatever you want with them. Most states, for example, their statutes are collected in actual books, and those books are published by publishers who sell them for a profit, and who can and sometimes do restrict access to the full book. And they claim the copyright, they claim, because, you know, obviously the laws are also public domain, is in the organization and the presentation and the font and everything else. So it's a question where the answer you would think would just be yes, go ahead, but there actually is a little bit of a wrinkle because of some of those, you know, private publications.
Interesting. Peter Barnes in the chat says some things like building codes are copyrighted. That's interesting. I would have thought that anything government should just be like, we can all use it however we want. I don't know.
It obviously should be.
Okay.
Well, and look, one of the things, right, that you know, we talked about in the Travis Wester episode, that like one of the things lawyers do with cases is we shepherdize cases, right? And that is, you get to see if there's still good law or not. And so he was citing a whole bunch of cases that had, you know, seriously negative implications. Your cat barking again?
Yeah, the cat is really neighbor's cat. Gosh, cat owners, would you just take better care of your cats and not leave them chained outside? Oh, wait, it's always dogs. Okay, go on.
Yeah, all right. Sorry, I was distracted.
Well, I think you're going to point out that people with the shepherdizing or whatever, do they make, they're making a product that they're making money off of, or...
Right. And so the reason it's called shepherdizing is because it used to be a big book that you had to go through, and the publisher of the book was Shepherds, and they owned it. And so it is why when we link a case on Google Scholar, the case is out there on Google Scholar, but it doesn't have the treatment of whether it's good law or not, because that's proprietary, that's owned by Shepherds.
Interesting. Yeah. Here's a one I really like by Robert Allman. How can I become a more informed voter in regard to judges? What issues do you think are important when voting for a judge? Are there any sources that can help me, a non-lawyer, decide not only if a particular judge is just properly trained, but also not a loon? And then there's a follow-up that's good, which is, what does Andrew think about elected judges? Not being American, the concept seems foreign to me, and it feels like it would run contrary to the principle of judicial independence.
Yeah. So let me start with the second question. I think that's terrible. It many states, I think almost all states, have elected judges, including electing state Supreme Court justices, which just mind-boggling to me. In Maryland, we kind of have a hybrid system where typically the practice is when there is that judges will retire, and there's a mandatory retirement by statute as well. Judges will retire, and then the governor will appoint individuals to fill those spots, and then they'll run, you know, so for re-election. And so you'll be able to tell the judges who have been at least vetted by other lawyers versus, you know, somebody who's just running to run. Underlying this tension is there are really, really strict rules about how judges can run for office. And those rules are not state political rules. They are in the model rules of professional conduct. So in other words, the enforcement is, because these judges are lawyers, you get disbarred if you break the rules, right? So, and the rules basically prohibit you from disclosing your political affiliation, from saying, vote for me, I'm going to put more people in jail, or the alternative, vote for me, I will not sentence anybody who's guilty of a, you know, drug crime, of a simple possession of drugs, you know, to prison. Like the kind of substantive issues you'd want to know where judges stand on, they're prohibited from discussing. So basically all they can do is be like, well, I am a sitting judge. I've been good at what I've been. And in fact, I go to, I mean, it's common practice in the law firms in Baltimore. I will attend the sitting judges luncheon fundraiser every year and, you know, donate money to that fund. And basically what that is designed to reelect the judges who have been appointed by the governor, even though, right, there's some that I agree with politically and some that I, but at least that way I know I'm supporting the slate of judges that are by and large competent and vetted, as opposed to just some guy who wants to run. So the answer to the question of how do you become an informed voter for judges is you don't. you really don't. Wow. You might look to see if the State Bar Association, you know, who they've endorsed and vote that line. But I wouldn't blame you if in an election you just left the judges line blank. Unless, of course, it's a super, you know, like when Roy Moore ran again for the Supreme Court justice in Alabama, right? Like, you know, vote for whoever's running against Roy Moore, but you don't need me to tell you that.
Yeah. This is interesting. Maybe this is a future main topic, so let me know. But Rapture Squirrel of the Apocalypse asks, so Congress passed a law with overwhelming bipartisan support calling for new sanctions against Russia. Trump just refused to enact the sanctions, it seems like. What can Congress do to compel him to act? Saka Shithole Thwackasumi says, this confuses me too. Congress's vote should be veto-proof. So why is this possible? Yeah, isn't that true? Or do they have to still go through the motion of him voting, vetoing it, and then they redo it?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, there's you can always procedurally veto and then force Congress to override the veto. It certainly does look like they have the votes. In terms of the implementation, I'm going to maybe surprise Rapture Squirrel here a little bit, because there's an obvious answer, right? The obvious answer is you're going to have to impeach Trump. But there's actually a little bit more here. If a task is something over which the executive or an executive branch agency or any officials thereof have no discretion, then you can petition the court for a writ of mandamus. And mandamus, right, the Latin root is mandatory. It is a writ to make them do stuff. So if the sanctions say the president shall direct the Secretary of the Treasury to freeze all assets from X bank account, right? And the president says, no, I'm not going to do that. Then you can actually go to court. It does not present the same separation of powers issue. You can go to a court and go, we want a writ of mandamus to force the president or force whoever's in charge at the Department of the Treasury to freeze that account. So there actually is something that can be done. Now, if there is any discretion, right? If it says the president shall use his best efforts to control the incoming funds from, you know, Russian criminals, including without limitation, seizing all bank account, you know, all assets and bank accounts, then the president can go, yeah, my best effort is nothing. And there's nothing you can do. You can't, you know, you cannot get a writ of mandamus when you have discretion.
Interesting. So,
but there is at least that.
Do you think that's an impeachable offense under a, what I know is not a, not an objective set of criteria, but just not doing something that Congress says to do?
Yeah. Again, the law on impeachment, I mean, I've always summarized it this way and I kind of stick by it, is
whatever Congress thinks.
A high crime and misdemeanor is whatever Congress thinks is a high crime.
But I mean, I'm just asking you, like, in normal times, is that something where it should be like, you need to do this?
I would argue, right? If you were asking me to write a law review article on is executive inaction a high crime or misdemeanor, I would say yes. And the reason that I would say yes is because it's the only remedy you have at that point, right? Yeah. If Congress directs the president to do something and the president decides not to, then there is, then literally the only things you can do is vote for a new president, or if it's a long ways off, impeach the president. And so that's why I would say, from an originalist perspective, that has to be an appropriate remedy, because there's no other remedy, and you can't have a situation in that where there's nothing you can do.
Ooh, I love this little one here. It's if you CKYOU. If a website says copyright 2016, do they waive copyrights in 2018 if they don't update the site, or is it in perpetuity throughout the universe?
Yeah, no, it's in perpetuity. You actually don't have to have the copyright notice. Mm. If I write something and I have expressed an intent to use it in commerce, then copyright attaches to it. The reason that you put a copyright notice on it is to make that clear. So let's use this podcast as an example. We explicitly put a copyright notice on the website. And the reason we do that is because you could certainly argue that, you know, there's an educational quality to this, that, you know, we're, and we want to be clear of, no. Like, we own this intellectual property. Like, we've created it, and you can't just, you know, resell it or something like that. So copyright notice expresses that clear intent. And the reason you put the date on it is not to kind of update going forward, but so that 5 years from now, if there is a lawsuit, you have in the record very clearly established when you first started using that material in commerce. Because the way in which you defeat copyright infringement is to show prior use of that same stuff. So you put the copyright 2016 on something, when you're reading it in 2018, you actually want that older date. You want the first time that you used it as a
copyright. Well, is that why? Because they usually go like 2010 through 2018. Is that why they do that?
Yeah, and that would indicate that there have been, you know, updates, amendments, that sort of thing.
Okay. Got one it's related to an article that obviously we can't read on the spot here, but Wiley Coyote Stable Genius asks, there's an article in Bloomberg that states Kelly is ending his conversations berating the DOJ with the disclaimer, nothing he says should be construed as asking them to do something illegal or unethical. Can such a statement save you? Does that count?
You're gonna have to go back over that a little bit, because I got lost a little bit in the middle.
Sure, yeah, it's just because he's referencing an article that obviously we're not reading, but I think there's reporting that with this DOJ Russia probe stuff, I think Kelly. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I was hoping you'd answer it without having to read the article, but it's saying that Kelly is essentially using this disclaimer in dealing with the DOJ. And so the question is, like, if you're dealing with the DOJ and you ask a bunch of stuff, but then at the end you say Nothing I say should be construed as asking you to do anything illegal or unethical. Does that save you, you know, even if you might have asked them to do something illegal or unethical?
So no, in the same way, right, when we had our show with Yvette, right, in the same way that you cannot get around
the my opinion
libel,
stuff.
You know, defamation laws by saying, it's my opinion that Thomas right. Smith is a pedophile, right? Like, you know, it
ooh, which
is
not. I'm cashing in on what you just said. I'm going to sue you. You heard it, everybody. You're my witnesses.
There are no magic words that you can use as a disclaimer if it is a fair implication that you've asked a judicial official to break the law, saying, "Now I'm not asking you to break the law right. here, but yeah, right."
So no. All right. Final question, and this is one I have as well. So I'm really glad someone asked this. Rapture Squirrel of the Apocalypse asks, Andrew, I'd like to know why you pick on Poor Nate Silver for calling the election wrong. I was keeping a modest eye on the polls, and 538 was consistently the most pessimistic of the bunch. If memory serves, they tended to be around 70% probability of Hillary, and they reminded folks that 30% is not terrible. If you want to harangue someone, bitch at the crooked media guys, they were really overselling. I agree, but they aren't pollsters. But yeah, go ahead. What do you think?
So two things on that. Certainly there were more of the polling aggregators, right? Like Dr. Wang from Princeton Election Consortium, I think had it as a 99% chance of a Hillary victory. So yeah, the aggregate numbers, they built in that level of risk. The reason I pick on Nate Silver is twofold. Number one, because you know, we knew each other back in the old baseball prospectus days, and now he's too big to come on opening arguments. but number two, and more realistically, if you looked at Nate Silver's models, they had Wisconsin and Michigan as dark blue states. I'm picking on him for a very specific thing, which is I think he depressed turnout in Wisconsin and Michigan of lukewarm Democrats who were like, yeah, why, you know, I don't really like Hillary and the whole emails thing. And yeah, Nate Silver says she's up by 8 points here, so I'm not going to go out, or I'm going to vote for Jill Stein or whatever. Now, there is, and I want to own up to this right here, right? That doesn't count Pennsylvania, right? Everybody said Pennsylvania was a battleground state, and, you know, there's no, so it's entirely on Jill Stein voters in Pennsylvania. But there's a little bit of it being on Nate Silver for Wisconsin and Michigan. And as a callback to opening arguments 1 through 4, you may recall we launched this show and I said to you in 04, that voters in West Virginia in 2000, Democrats in West Virginia in 2000 didn't realize they were in a battleground state until right. George W. Bush won it. I mean, that was a state Michael Dukakis won, but the Republicans saw a change in demographics. They worked it underneath the radar, and the Democratic Party establishment was complacent. And now you think of West Virginia as a deep red state, and it is, but it was not until 2000. So, that's why I pick on Nate.
Well, Silver. I listened. Did you happen to? Well, there was a sort of a retrospective they did on their podcast at one point about this, and it definitely cast it in a different light than you had been. And I mean, there could always be a sort of you know, hindsight 2020 thing going on, but I also was surprised, as was Rapture Squirrel of the Apocalypse. If you're claiming that he had those two states as dark blue, I don't remember that. So but I do also remember, as with Rapture Squirrel here, that they weren't the ones saying, like, you know, 99% or anything like that.
Yeah, no, that is true. But you know, it the responsibility, I mean, you and I are in agreement on this, that, you know, we said this in our recording with Eli the day after the election, which I think is the only reason I'm sane today, is that the three of us got on to sort of scream into a microphone for 2 hours. This 2016 election is on the backs of disaffected and bored and stupid liberals. And so, you know, if I can pass that up the chain a little bit, you know, so feeding into that, I think, was the perception that Wisconsin and Michigan were safe. But But, you know, that's where the blame lies. So there is some tongue in cheek when I am blaming Nate Silver. But again, you know, from atop his stacks of $100 bills, I'm sure he's not too hurt by it. So,
all right. Well, that's it for Patron Q&A 7. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. Thanks for a great and vibrant question thread. And hey, we'll see you around this time in a month.
Absolutely.